Hello, my name is Rich Jones. I'm a co-founder of U-Turn and the Chief Clinical Officer of U-Turn Health, and I'm also a co-host of this wonderful podcast.
And my name is Liz, and I'm a co-founder of U-Turn and a co-host of U-Learn U-Turn.
And let's get the show on the road.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in today. My name is Erin Craw, and I am the Strategic Account Manager for Client Success here at U-Turn Health, working primarily in the public sector. Today, we have Stephanie with us. She's a writer, an author, a speaker, and a law enforcement veteran. Stephanie's worked in three different police agencies on the Central Coast of California for the past 16 years of service, and she now works with different departments and corporations, increasing organizational safety and wellness. We're so fortunate to have you with us here today, and I know our listeners are going to really learn a lot from you. I thought it might be best for you to tell us more about you and your story rather than me just kind of read off your bio. So I'm going to kick it to you, Stephanie, to kind of walk us through who you are, where you're at now, and how you got to U-Turn Health Podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. First, thank you so much for having me. I'm definitely a big fan of some of your guests that you've had and topics that you've discussed. So I am really grateful to sort of be among them with you here today. And as you know, Erin, you and I are friends and educational colleagues. So I think maybe this conversation might be a little eye-opening because I think some of the things we're going to be discussing, I don't know that you and I have particularly talked about them in our conversation. So I'm equally excited and sort of terrified to have this conversation with a friend, but I suppose we'll cross that bridge here shortly. But a little bit about me. My identity is pretty multifaceted these days, but like you mentioned, I am a law enforcement veteran. I started my law enforcement career in 2006 to 2022. The last several of those years, I was a police officer. Before that, I was actually a dispatcher. And then before that, I did some different non-sworn jobs that included working for ABC, Alcoholic Beverage Control, working with them and working for them. So these days, I'm a business owner. I'm a wife to sheriff's deputy. So my husband is also in law enforcement. I'm a mom to two little boys, the daughter of two cops. So definitely a law enforcement bloodline. Big animal lover, wine drinker, psychology nerd. I could go on and on. But I think more so these days, I spend my time using my degrees in psychology to really aim to improve the lives and workplaces of first responders. And so I do a lot of presentations, trainings, I write articles, and really go to different departments all over California and really starting to be national now to really help increase organizational wellness and the health of individual employees.
Fantastic. Wow. Well, that is a very long and growing list of amazing accomplishments that you've done. And I know law enforcement is just one of the things on that list and a really important one and one that took up 16 years of your career. I'd love to learn a little bit more about how you would describe your law enforcement career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think mine was perhaps a little different because both of my parents were cops. So growing up as a cop's kid, especially with both parents in law enforcement, was quite challenging at times. And so it really cemented early on this identity in law enforcement, for good or for bad, which I think sort of goes along with some of my story that I'm sure we'll get into a little bit later on. But I knew pretty early on as a young girl that I wanted to be a part of law enforcement, but I sort of figured that it would be more through a non-sworn route, like dispatch. And so when I became a dispatcher, really liked it initially, but I felt internally I wasn't really completely fulfilled in terms of like being able to help. Like I just felt like I could be doing more. And so that was a really big drive in my life was helping. And I think probably because I had first responder parents that really instilled that in me. But I knew that I wanted more outside of the headset. And so eventually I did that. I went through the police academy. And initially I really loved being a cop. The job, helping others, keeping people safe. My experience was pretty positive. Really up until the year of 2020. And the year 2020 was really when I had a pretty sharp decline in my overall health, my mental health for sure. Around this time, I had been a cop for a few years and my department was very understaffed. We were really overworked, lots of mandatory overtime. And my department just really imploded from having a lot of internal turmoil. There were coworkers suing other coworkers, police officers suing their supervisors, just a really unhealthy place to be at this time. So a lot of organizational and occupational stressors, and honestly, not a lot of supportive mechanisms in place. And then from a personal standpoint, I didn't really have many healthy coping skills. So I think I really struggled dealing with sort of all the emotions that came with all of those stressors. And then, as you know, this was also the year of COVID, George Floyd's death, and sort of the start of the defund the police movement. I myself worked in a pretty affluent sort of college town. So as you can imagine, there were a lot of people in that jurisdiction that were not particularly fond of police, especially during this time. So I would really struggle at home with my own personal thoughts and experiences relating to my job. But then I would go into work and be consistently spit on, cursed at, assaulted. I was told I should be raped. I mean, you name it, I probably experienced it. And for what? All really because of the uniform that I wore at work. So in late 2020, I think that was really the point in time where I really, really struggled. I felt really isolated. I had some significant traumas that I didn't really deal with properly. That I think sort of the umbrella term that covers a lot of those traumas was significant injuries and death to children that I was exposed to. And I just felt really lost because I felt like I was sacrificing so much of my personal life, especially my relationship with my family, which included my young son at the time. And I was like, for what? For a job that citizens hated me. My supervisors didn't really care about me. I've got coworkers that are super paranoid. There's no trust. I just felt really handcuffed with some organizational stressors. But then from the standpoint of a police officer, I just felt like I wasn't really able to do what I signed up to do, to protect and serve, you know? And so that played a big impact on the decline of my mental health. So luckily for me, I had been pretty extensively researching suicide and suicide prevention for about the last decade, kind of on the educational front. And I started recognizing in myself when I was a cop, I had a lot of the warning signs that I teach to others. And I'm like, holy cow. So I ended up reaching out and saw a law enforcement specific psychologist for several months. I also went on antidepressants, which really helped me a lot with some of the ideating that I was going through. I still continued to work as a cop. Nobody knew. And the reason why I like to mention that, you know, I don't have to say these things. I could be very vague in this part of my story, but I do think that sharing these specific details really helps with this stigma, right? First responder stigma is definitely alive and well. And with law enforcement, especially, it was as if, you know, if you're not 100% perfect mentally, you are therefore by default not healthy and maybe even not fit for duty. So I was so worried about losing my gun and my badge, which meant that I could lose my job. I was so worried that if anybody found out that I was struggling, it would really create this cascade of events that I didn't really know what the end result was going to be. And so I think that it's really important to really normalize that I reached out for mental health. That really helped. I reached out for medication. That really helped. And I continued to be a cop for a while after that. Ultimately, in 2022, I did leave for many factors. Yeah, that's kind of a long version sort of my experience.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, first and foremost, for trusting us with your story. And, you know, as you were talking, Stephanie, I'm just picturing layer after layer of stressor and of this cumulative nature of what you were experiencing. It wasn't this one thing. It was, you know, the societal factors, it's the organizational layer, it's the personal stressors. And so I'm just kind of picturing you and a law enforcement officer that I worked with, And a former research project had one time explained to me, it's like a backpack, and you are given a backpack at the beginning of your career, and you kind of put a rock in for all the different stressors and traumas, and eventually you just can't walk with that backpack on anymore, and you absolutely have to put it down. And that's kind of what I was picturing. And you're nodding your head, so I'm hoping you can kind of relate to that, because that's, as you were telling your story, I just vividly could picture you having all these different types of stressors and this cumulative nature of what you're going through. And then on top of it, you really described not having those strategies. And I love that idea of strategy and practice, because I think that's, you know, that's something you and I talk a lot about, just on a personal friendship and also colleague level, is it's how do we get people to feel like they are in control? They have that efficacy of their own health and wellness, and those strategies become so critical, because that's what's going to get them through on those day to day, you know, to avoid that cumulative nature of it. And, you know, as you were describing too, kind of the trajectory of eventually leaving that position and where you are at now, it really does also, as I'm just listening to you tell your story, seem like once you had that kind of more sense of control and efficacy in what you were doing, and one of the things that you highlighted that I think a lot of listeners can relate to, even if it's not in the first responder realm, but the power of feeling like you started to do a job for a reason, you were hired to do a specific job. And when we lose that sense of professional efficacy, you know, that's something we talk about with burnout, right? It's one of those dimensions of burnout, is feeling like it doesn't really matter what we're doing. We're not getting anywhere. We're not really making a difference. And I feel like specifically for someone like yourself who literally did that job for that reason, to make a difference, I can't fathom how stressful and frustrating that probably was. And I know you've definitely talked obviously about some of these kind of key gaps, it sounds like, in where if the first responder world might need some additional improvements in terms of access. And so can you talk to me a little bit about, like I said, I know that you've touched upon the organizational stressors and this lack of focus on strategies and coping, and you know, you're already in an understaffed department. So you know, now on top of that, you don't really have the skill set necessarily in place to cope. So where are those gaps, in addition to what you just kind of told us, where do those still lie, and where do we need to go next from your perspective?
Yeah. Great question. Sort of a difficult answer. I think it really depends on the individual, but there certainly are some generalized areas where we need massive improvements, especially on the first responder front and especially in the law enforcement industry. I kind of boil it all down to three things. One, the destigmatizing mental health help and maintenance. Two, the training of our first responders to create and cultivate healthy coping skills, which not only helps with the inevitable trauma, but also helps us when we over-identify with our jobs, right? We are more than just our job, but that's hard for a lot of our first responders to see past that. And then three, creating sort of this culture of connectedness. Now, I say these three things for a reason, which I certainly will explain. But first, if I can, I want to maybe tell a quick story and kind of highlight why this is all really important.
Yes, please.
So in 2011, I was dating a really great guy, my boyfriend. He was a cop, and at this time, I was a dispatcher. We were at two different agencies, but pretty close by. And he and I were friends for a few years before we became romantic and decided to take our friendship to the next level. But I think he and I bonded really early on in our friendship days. We bonded over having police dads, which I know, Aaron, you and I have bonded over that as well. So for he and I, our dads actually worked at the same agency that my boyfriend was a cop at. So all three of them were at one department, and then I was at a second location, a second department. But for him, for my boyfriend, his job as a cop was 110% his identity. He completely over-identified as his job. He ate, drank, breathed police work. Like, that is who he was. So sort of long story short, in October of 2011, he was working his normal graveyard shift and learned that an IA, an investigation, was coming down the pipe for him. And regardless of the reason for the IA, Whether or not the allegations were true, I honestly don't think the outcome would have been any different because of this identity piece, because his identity was completely interwoven with being a cop. So I think, knowing him as well as I did, the thought of this investigation potentially, you know, depersonalizing him by maybe one day taking away this job, his identity, I think was just too much for him to think of, think about. And I firmly believe that there were some organizational failures at this time, some traumatic calls that he didn't really process that I know changed him, some personal failures on his part for sure. But really all boils down to he did not have the adequate coping skills to really work through and process everything, which by the way, kind of a digression here, is so important, especially when it comes to our first responders, because what I've seen, what I've studied, what I've been through personally, to be quite frank, without these healthy coping skills in place, we humans will resort to impulsive pleasure seeking behaviors as a way to cope with what we can't really process cognitively, right? So behaviors like affairs, bad money moves that feel good in the moment, self-medicating with drugs and alcohol. For my boyfriend, this was true. So on what I think he thought was his last shift before being placed on administrative leave, he made the very permanent decision to kill himself with his duty weapon on duty just outside of his patrol car. So as you can imagine, obviously this event really affected me, his family, certainly our whole department for a long time, and really changed, I think, the trajectory of my mindset as it relates to the impact that our jobs can have on us. And it really started this obsessive curiosity about studying suicide. So I got my bachelor's in psychology, my master's in IO psych, industrial and organizational psychology, all with sort of this emphasis in studying workplace contributing factors to suicide, most often within first responder agencies. So from then until now, I've sort of seen these three really underlying contributing factors in a lot of the situations and case studies that I've been involved with that contribute to a mental health decline, especially when it comes to suicidal ideations. And these three contributing factors are: one, isolation, whether that's perceived or real, doesn't matter. Two, having a low self-esteem, low self-efficacy, which you just highlighted earlier. And then three, having a certain occupational trauma, which is this desensitization to pain and suffering of others. And then another big contributing factor that I saw in a lot, not all, but in a lot of the cases that I studied as well, was sort of this loss or confusion around someone's identity, much like my boyfriend went through. And so these four, certainly the first three, but these four really encompass really the perfect storm of something that I now call workicide. So not suicide, which is death by self, not homicide, which is death by other, but workicide, death by career. And this is especially true with our first responders. So to answer your question, these gaps are: one, we, the industry, as first responders, and really everywhere, but especially in the first responder areas, we need to start normalizing help seeking in regards to mental health and therapy. You know, for many first responder organizations, the prevailing notion is that seeking support is like this sign of weakness. And actually, this assumption turns out to be factually incorrect. I know you would appreciate this because you are a fellow psych nerd just like myself, but there's a lot of research that consistently supports that those that seek mental health help are actually those that have increased strength. So those that pursue getting help actually possess higher levels of resilience, higher cognitive functioning, and higher social connectedness. So it really isn't until we collectively realize and sort of outwardly confirm that seeking mental health help is not a sign of weakness, it's actually a sign of strength, really nothing is going to change. Number two, we need regular and consistent training to boost these healthy coping skills. So we can not only survive these high performance, high stress jobs, but thrive as well. And then lastly, three, like I mentioned, we really need to create a culture of connectedness. And especially during these IA investigations, much like kind of what was the catalyst for the demise for my boyfriend. You know, during these IA processes for most organizations, an employee makes a mistake or a perceived mistake, right? So the department launches into this investigation. And during this time, this perceived offender might be put on administrative leave with pay. They might not be allowed to come into work. They're prohibited from talking to employees about certain things, which makes others in the department kind of shy away from interacting with this person, right? Because they don't want this negative appearance that it might bring. Mm-hmm. And so this really starts to increase that sense of isolation. And from some officers that I've talked to in here in California, their departments go so far as to prohibit them from leaving the county that they reside mm-hmm. in. And then they have to call in each morning to sort of check in. So basically, your life now is one of a parolee or a probationer. For what? So this unverified transgression, right? So, and don't get me wrong here. Like there are certainly plenty of times where someone legitimately messes up, and I get that. But there are also a lot of times where these allegations are unfounded, and then the employee mm-hmm. goes back to work. And even if the outcome is that they did nothing wrong, they now wear this jacket of shame, and everybody is suddenly different around them. So there needs to be a lot of changes in the occupational and organizational realm specific to law enforcement, first responders, certainly, because that really is a big piece for why we're having a lot of mental health declines, especially recently.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much again for sharing. And I'm so sorry about the loss of your boyfriend, and what a tribute to that relationship, everything that you're doing and really making it you know, your dedication to fixing this and pushing back on this notion that there's this perceived weakness that we know is there, right? That sense of stigma. But I loved your comment about how absolutely the research backs it up, that actually the people who say I need help are the ones that have a higher level of emotional intelligence. And emotional intelligence is such a huge component, I think, of the first responder world, because you absolutely have to be so intact with your emotions and how to manage them on the job. But I think what rarely happens is, yeah, you might think of that in the sense that I'm able to kind of manage my emotions and respond to a call. And, you know, we sometimes call that putting them into compartments almost, and, you know, just kind of storing our emotions away. But in reality, that emotional intelligence is really so much more than that. It's so much more of understanding how you're feeling, why you're feeling it, and what to do next. And so when you highlighted that, I thought, wow, that's a whole area in itself to really focus on, instead of, you know, I think oftentimes too, we're so inundated in this mental health conversation at large that we forget about the details and what it really means. You know, I think one of my biggest fears, and I'm so passionate about mental health, which you know, because we've talked so many times about it, is I don't want it to become a buzzword. And that's a fear. And I think in the first responder world, especially where they're getting the same message over and over again, and there is a cultural kind of challenge there, I think the more that you kind of push this emotional intelligence and strategies and self-efficacy, it's a whole different kind of almost a reframing of what's needed. And so when you were describing that, that's all I could think about as well. It's really reframing, you know, moving away from, yes, we know the stigma is there, but here are some ways that we can kind of shift the narrative about mental health and the training to be more skill set, you know, skills based, and really putting the first responder back in control of who they are, what they're doing. And one of the things I did want to talk a little bit more about, if you're open to it, is this idea of kind of over-identifying with work and how that could have so many sort of negative repercussions. And I know you saw that firsthand as a romantic partner. You also kind of described it a little bit, just in terms of observing other first responders and doing the same thing, where it just becomes your whole sense of self. And it has to be super hard not to do that, especially as a first responder, where, you know, that it's so much of who you are, right? Even when you take off that uniform, I mean, you're still a police officer. I know that just being raised by one. Like, my dad was a cop even in his Jets t-shirt and sweatpants, right? So so talk to me a little bit about your thoughts and your experiences. I know you have a psychology background. So, you know, how do you balance the two? Because it is such an identifying job, right? And you want to have that sense of pride in who you are as a community servant and really helping the people around you. So how do you balance that?
Yeah, it is tough because, yeah, I'm speaking for myself, certainly, but I feel like a lot of first responders and police officers out there that I didn't identify as a cop when I was working my 12-hour shift. You know, like I was a cop 24/7. I go to the grocery store. I carry a gun. I'm driving down the road. I see something bad happen. Like, I'm not just a cop when I have my uniform on. And so I do think it is difficult, especially when you have such a moral occupation, to have those healthy boundaries. But this sort of sense of over-identifying with our career basically all boils down to really basing my entire identity and self-esteem on my professional accomplishments or status. And that can be really problematic because, as we saw with my boyfriend and with others, this really contributes to a narrow self-concept, and my worth, therefore, is solely determined by my career, my success at work. And this can really create us to neglect or situations where we neglect other important aspects of life, like personal relationships, our hobbies, self-care, wellness. And there's a lot of research out there. You know, I'm going to mention the research part to my fellow psych nerd here, but you know, this over-identifying piece, especially within first responders, there's a lot of studies that show this increases stress, increases burnout, and increases mental health issues. One term that is sort of becoming a little bit more popular these days that I didn't hear about until recently was called superhero syndrome. Superhero syndrome is a term that anyone can experience, but we are seeing it a lot more with our first responders. And it's where these individuals, you know, they face this immense pressure to sort of fulfill society's perception of them as heroes, or perhaps their own expectations of taking on that role. And so they develop this over-identification with this profession, neglecting other aspects of their lives, and feel this overwhelming responsibility to just do it all, do everything all of the time for everyone, and really going above and beyond these professional duties a lot of times. And so especially in that case with this superhero syndrome, I think that is really leading to the lack of healthy coping skills, self-care, personal relationships outside of the job, which are all important to having a multifaceted identity and not over-identifying.
Well, I hadn't heard of that term before, but it makes so much sense. And I used to describe my dad as Batman because he drove an undercover like black Dodge Charger. And so it's so real, right? We do that even as family members. You have so much pride. You're proud of them. And so, you know, but you don't think about the other side of that. And the, like you said, the immense pressure that comes with this persona of, well, what if I'm not Batman? What if I'm not this superhero? Or what if I do need help or do need a break? And, you know, this kind of leads into what I wanted to talk a little bit about, these different dimensions of wellness. I feel like oftentimes when we have conversations around health and well-being, and I know I've talked to a lot of first responders just through my own research and work, and it always seems to be that we think of mental health as this one thing, or we think of well-being as this one thing, but there are these different dimensions. And so I would love you to kind of walk our listeners through why different dimensions matter, how they kind of fit into this first responder world, and why it's even more important for first responders to really understand that there's different dimensions for health and well-being. Why is this so critical?
Yeah, you know, this topic is one that I'm definitely passionate about. I think you and I have had like a dozen conversations about this one particular topic. So definitely something that I hope to bring information and education on for sure, especially with first responders. But this sense of wellness is really essential to help us cope with the inevitable occupational and organizational stressors that we experience, right? Self-care is important because it leads to the discovery of healthy coping skills, which helps us de-stress and process life and all of that. And then that leads to this sort of overall wellness. And being well leads to resilience. So mm-hmm. wellness is how we become healthier, happier, and more resilient in life. So I'm definitely a big fan of Dr. Peggy Swarbrick's 8 Dimensions of Wellness. This is something that I myself use that I teach a lot about. But these 8 dimensions of wellness are this: physical wellness, emotional wellness, intellectual wellness, spiritual wellness, social wellness, environmental wellness, occupational wellness, and financial wellness. So there's 8 of them. And each dimension is interconnected and really addresses one area that can help, when combined, create a balanced and fulfilling life. And so it's really important to emphasize that, you know, if we neglect one dimension, that will negatively impact other dimensions, right? So if I am 100% focused on my job, my occupational wellness, perhaps, all the other 7 aspects of my life that are important as well are going to struggle. It's going to negatively impact those. So I feel like these 8 dimensions sort of gives us a roadmap for what we should do to work well and be well at home. And that's really important because as I know, you know, Aaron, police officers especially have a really hard time on the mental health front. And, there's a really sad statistic that, police officers are 54% more likely to die by suicide than the general population. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that percentage is that police officers on average, one statistic had said that on average, a police officer sees around 188 critical incidents in their lifetime, which involves death, violence, that desensitization of pain and suffering that I mentioned. That number compared to the average person not in law enforcement, they will see 2 to 3 in their lifetime, critical incidents in their lifetime. So big difference. And so this wellness component is especially critical for our law enforcement personnel. So you know me, I can talk about this topic all day. So let me know further into each dimension.
Yeah, no, that was fantastic. And I think it really paints a nice picture for those who are listening who maybe don't really understand or hadn't heard about the different dimensions when you think about wellness. And I think what you did really nicely too, in terms of just highlighting the value of thinking beyond it being one thing. And when you really zoom out in looking at a first responder's life, there's just so many different systems that they're a part of. And you talked a little bit about this when you told your story of, you know, there's a societal factor. There is, you know, a whole system that you're a part of as a law enforcement officer, especially in society. And what does that look like? And what does that sound like? And then there's this organizational system that you're a part of. And then you're a part of our families are a system in itself. So you're constantly navigating these different systems that have different pressures. And so when we think about these different dimensions, it's so critical, as you stated, for first responders to not only understand them, but also be able to have the resources and the strategies. And I think this is where, you know, so much of the work that you're doing is so powerful, because we don't see it very often. You know, new programs and trainings really focus on specifically these different dimensions, and how do we kind of build these different strategies, different coping mechanisms to really address these different dimensions all at once, right? And I think it can be overwhelming if we're like, we're going to change every dimension at the same time. But it really is a process. And when we talk about wellness and when you look at the definitions, you know, it really is this ongoing process. It's not a one-time thing, like you hit wellness and you're good. And so tell us a little bit more about what you're currently working on, how that kind of ties in. And I know that you have so much going on, you're doing so many amazing things, but one of the things that obviously you've been working on is this incredible book. So talk to us a little bit about that and tell our listeners what you're doing and how that connects obviously to our overall conversation today.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. So yeah, I do have a book that's going to be coming out in about a month or so, and it's called Work Aside, Death by Career. And it really is sort of all of my information and education on workplace contributing factors to suicide and sort of this decline in mental health, really all compiled in one place. So it's really the combination of my reading dozens and dozens of books, listening to too many podcasts to count, probably including U-Turn as well, scanning through articles, taking lots of online courses. I mean, you name it, I probably did it. And so this book really dives deep into exploring the dark depths of suicide with the hope to therefore offer solutions into suicide prevention with the hope of ultimately helping others. So I talk about some of the things that we've mentioned here. I talk about really seven steps that an individual can take to overcome this internal sense of death by career, or perhaps even the external end result of workplace contributing suicide. Because ultimately, I want people to be work well and live a life that they love, especially for our first responders. And so I do have the book. I also have a 10-week online course that complements my book. Outside of that, I'm pursuing my PhD in IO psych with that emphasis on workplace contributing factors to suicidal ideations and behaviors. And I'm currently working with several different organizations and clinician companies to create workplace surveys, wellness curriculum, different trainings, because ultimately I want to be there to help the helpers. I think one thing why I'm so passionate about this, and to sort of wrap up, I think the culmination of a lot of my educational endeavors is when I was going through what I experienced, I started asking questions to other first responders. And I found that my feelings, my decline in mental health, wasn't unusual. It's actually very common. So then that got me to asking questions to clinicians that treat first responders. Why is this happening? How prevalent in this? Is this? Is this just a me problem? And what I found is that first responders can and do have a decline in their mental health because of what they see and experience from their jobs. This is normal. This is not an unusual thing. But I was never told that. I was never trained on that. You know, I went through so many trainings on how to survive if someone is trying to kill me, right? As a cop. Mm-hmm. But what if the person who's trying to kill me is me? Why was I never trained on that? That needs to be in police academies, fire academies, dispatch academies. This is stuff that needs to be out there for everyone to see. So, first responders are our helpers, and it's about time that we all help them. And so that is what I'm focusing on these days.
Well, thank you so much for describing all of those different ventures. And gosh, I don't know how you do it all, but you are just making such impressive change. And I think too, in discussing your book, I mean, I can just feel the energy and the passion coming from your voice. And so I'm certain that so many people will be interested in reading that book, and as well as the 10-week course that kind of complements what you talk about in the book. And like you said, that sense of curiosity and wanting to know more and realizing that other people want to know more too, and maybe they just weren't asking those questions. And I love that this resource then kind of walks them through things that other people might, you know, it kind of goes to that notion of if someone asks a question, probably someone else in the classroom has the same question, so you might as well ask it sort of thing. And so yeah. I love that you've created this for so many people that will come after you and really paving the way in terms of starting the conversation and just giving a tool that can be utilized at someone's discretion. I think that's important too. It's something that, you know, because this population, it's so hard to get up the courage to seek support and ask for help. It's a book. It's a course that you can take. It's something that's tangible that you can take action for yourself and really start to kind of get those answers to some of those probably questions that you shared with them. How do they get to the book? What's the process? I know we'll obviously from a U-Turn Health side keep everyone up to date on how to get it and information from Stephanie. But should we look at your LinkedIn? What's the best way to kind of get to this amazing resource?
Yeah, absolutely. I am on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. And so if people want to connect with me personally, they can find me on there. My name is Stephanie Kieso. That's spelled K-I-E-S-O-W. But for the book, for the course, for sort of all of these wellness materials, that can be all found on my website, which is beworkwell.com. So beworkwell, it's all there, all available. So definitely a place that I encourage people to check out.
Excellent. We'll make sure those links are also a part of where you guys can find her bio and more information about Stephanie. That'll be linked right where you found this podcast. Stephanie, thank you so much for your time and for, you know, just being vulnerable with us, sharing your story, really providing such an in-depth description about not only your own lived experiences and your professional expertise, but where you see the future for health and wellness in terms of the first responder world and just the impact that you're having. If you haven't heard it lately, I'll tell you right now, I know that you're making a true difference. And I know that that was so important to you from the very start of your career. So, you know, it's such a journey that you've been on, and it's really impressive just to see. And now you're still hustling and finding other ways to really help make positive impact in first responders. So thank you so much for your time and for being here with us. And I'm certain that all of our listeners are excited to see what else is to come from you, Stephanie. And we'll keep everyone up to date and definitely continue to keep you posted on that book, and we'll be pushing that out too. And so if you have any questions, like I said, her contact information, the LinkedIn link and her website will be right where you found the podcast. Stephanie, thanks again. We really appreciate you.
Thanks, Erin.